You're listening to the Broadway Belters podcast, where we sit down with some of Broadway's brightest stars to learn more about their journey behind the scenes. Hello, friends, and welcome back to the Broadway Belters podcast. I am your host, Nick Ferreo, and I am so happy to welcome our guest today, Mr. Will Blum. Will has been seen on Broadway in Grease, The Book of Mormon, School of Rock, Torch Song, and most recently in Beetlejuice. Welcome, Will.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. Before we talk about all these fabulous Broadway credits, can you tell us a bit more about where you grew up and how you found your way into theater?
Sure. I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee, and I got my start in ballet. Actually, I think, you know, the first sort of performance I ever saw was The Nutcracker when I was about three. And apparently I tried to jump up on the stage and it's sort of all downhill, uphill from there. Yeah, so I didn't really know about musicals other than the Rodgers and Hammerstein movies. That's what I thought musicals were until I was about eight. When my aunt gave me the Phantom of the Opera double cassette. And, you know, I said, what is this? She was like, oh, it's a musical on Broadway. And I said, what's Broadway? And that was the real start of everything. But I took ballet probably till I was about from like 3 to 12, honestly, but started doing musicals when I was about 8. I was never very good at ballet. So once singing started getting involved in the performance, I started finding, you know, where my path was. And so, yeah, I did a lot of community theater in a town near Tennessee called Clarksville at the Roxy Regional Theater. And they really taught me everything I know. I think you posted a video of Jamie Lee Kirshner, you know, in Rent the other day, right? Am I correct?
Yes. Yes.
And she was the star of the Roxy when I was growing up.
Oh, really?
She was a couple years old. Idolized her because she had this sort of extraordinary talent, especially for Clarksville, Tennessee. It was this thing that, you know, I idolized her and ended up briefly getting to work with her a little bit. We overlapped just a little bit. And even in that time, she taught me so much as well. So
that's awesome. And then you ultimately found your way to Boston Conservatory for musical theater. For our younger listeners, what was your college experience like there? And what advice would you give to anyone who's just starting that daunting audition process for schools?
Sure. I would think about, you know, I kind of went into the game really uninformed. It took me a long time to even understand that musical theater was a separate major than just a theater or an acting major. And so I was looking at schools at first that didn't even have a musical theater program, you know, and sort of weaned my way into the Boston Conservatory. It was a great fit for me because I am not academic beyond the arts. You know, I took chemistry in high school 4 times and I failed every single time. And I tried, my brain didn't understand it. I can sing the full score of Sweeney Todd, but I can't do chemistry. Like, it's just not in my brain. So going to a conservatory was the best option for me because I could learn math through music theory. It was giving me the appropriate windows to learn these sort of necessary skills for anyone. Even in high school, I was skipping classes to paint the set for Midsummer Night's Dream. I didn't care about biology and these things. You know, I just wanted to paint and to sing and do all these things. So I knew that a conservatory setting was appropriate for me. And they also had, I'm a director as well, and there at the school, you have the option to emphasize in a certain category. And they had a directing emphasis. And so my senior year, I directed, you know, all these different pieces. And that's really what sold Boston Conservatory for me, was that not only was it just completely arts-based, but that I could focus in on this part that I really, really was interested in.
Oh, cool. That's awesome. You made your Broadway debut in 2008 in the revival of Grease as Roger. What can you tell us about that audition process, and what do you remember from that very first night on Broadway?
Sure. So I got really lucky in a lot of ways. I got a job doing Seussical the Musical right out of school for TheaterWorks USA, like a little tour where we were the stage managers. We put up the set and, you know, every day and all that sort of thing. And when I came back from that, I had become equity, so I started going to, on average, really like 10 EPAs and ECCs a week, equity principal calls and equity chorus calls, and things I just wasn't even right for just because I wanted to get out there. I wanted to be seen. And in a way, there's so much rejection if I went to that many a week, I'd forget that I didn't get a callback for the thing before and really took out the stakes of, oh God, I need this, which okay. I did, but it was a really great way of tricking myself into just being like, you get to sing with a piano today. That's it. And so I didn't get a callback for a single thing for however many months, and not one, you know, not a wow. single callback. And then there were two EPAs for Greece. I think they were even required okay. at this point. So I went to the, like, there was one Monday and then the Monday afterward. I went to the first one. And it just so happens that Daniel Everidge, who was playing Roger, had tore his ACL and his meniscus jumping off the car the night before. And so I went into, I think the callback process was, if not the next day, you know, I don't think there were multiple callbacks. I just remember it going very quick because they needed to replace him immediately. Okay. And I don't know if you know the original recording or if you saw it, but Daniel Everidge belts a high G in Mooning, which I definitely could not do. You know, I'd never gone above a C, you know, sort of in college. Okay. And I was coaching it with a friend, you know, the day before, and he was like, try a D, try it, see if you can get, you know, and I did. And it worked. It, you know, I was like, okay. And I think it was just like, I need to hit this in order to get this role. So this right. is why it's going to happen.
We're going to do it.
And at the callback, you know, I was there with now guys who I've been in callbacks with for years. You know, our casting pool is kind of small. And I think I went in first and I hit the D. I hit it. And the other guys went in after me. And after the two guys, you know, went and like cracked on the high note, I think they tried it because I had done it. You know, the two guys who were there called back for Danny in unison just looked up at me and said, you got it. And I was like, I know, but I didn't want to say it. And I think I got the call later that afternoon.
Quick.
Yeah. And I mean, I think I immediately went to the theater for a fitting. I mean, it all happened so fast. But the greatest lesson from this is that if I'd gone to the second EPA, this, you know, the Monday after, I wouldn't have gotten it because I, you know, the person would have already been cast.
Yeah.
Whoever else it would have been. So that's why I always tell people, show up. It doesn't matter. A lot of times it won't even matter about like if you're the most talented or the best looking or whatever. It's just like
timing.
You show up today,
yeah.
you know, and that's the first step. That's it. I always say it's luck because it really is. You know, it's just yeah. luck that this all happened this way. So
it all lined up.
So I made my Broadway debut, I think like 2 weeks later. And it was wonderful. It was yeah. a wonderful feeling, especially being so young and so excited. You know, I love theater. And so I loved it. I was able to reach what I had been trying to reach, you know, since I was right. eight. At that age, that just meant the world to me then.
What was the most shocking thing or, you know, the most surprising from your first Broadway experience that you hadn't expected or you expected something to be different and it wasn't what you thought it was going to be?
I would say almost all of it. Okay. It was a really, in all honesty, it was a really hard experience because I came into the show 9 months after they'd opened. I was the first replacement of any kind into it. Okay. And the guy I was replacing was beloved, as rightfully so. He's an amazing guy, you know, but he was a cast clown. And they had received really poor reviews, and the creative team was not really caring about that, you know what I mean? In a certain sense, so the team assembled there was not the most welcoming, most loving, you know what I mean? There were certain people who were just like wonderful, but it felt like I had come into like a bad party or something like that.
Okay.
And I remember a month into my run, just like washing my hair out in the sink, and I just started crying because I was so disappointed that my dream wasn't what I thought it would be. And that I had had more fun doing Seussical the Musical, setting up a, you know, a Marley set in a children's gymnasium at 6 a.m.
Wow.
than I did at the Brooks Atkinson Theater. It was really heartbreaking to understand that Broadway doesn't solve all your problems. And I try to tell people, like, Broadway's just another house. You know, it's just a set of circumstances, and it really comes down to the show you're doing and the people that you're with. And, you know, in Greece, it was one of those things where I always say, like, you adopt the mentality of the show you're doing backstage.
Sure.
And, like, Greece is a bunch of bitchy teenagers and a show about kind of nothing or sort of, like, surface stuff. And so they were putting out the national tour, and I knew Daniel was coming back. And so I asked to leave. I said, would you let me go do the tour? Because I knew if I started with a company, you know, maybe I'd enjoy, you know. I mean, I loved doing the show. I loved the part. You know, I mean, I had the best.
Oh, yeah.
It's like I always say, like, some of the some of the worst shows are the most fun to do. You know, I'm like, Footloose is the most fun I've ever had doing a show, you know.
So much fun.
It was really fun to just be like the clown of that show. So yeah. I did. I left and it ended up being an incredible decision because the show on Broadway ended up closing before Daniel could even come back. They announced their closing the opening night of the tour.
Oh, wow.
So I was like, wow, I didn't
that
realize
was a good
I
decision.
Got my boat out of there. But I did the tour then for a year and a half. So I did that production of Grease total for 2 years, which has been the reason that I've been able to be picky since. You know what I mean? It was the perfect thing to create a nest egg for myself to say, okay, what's next now? You know, and I can chill when I'm unemployed instead of freaking out, you know. So I'll always be thankful to Grease for what it gave me, you know.
Yeah,
and I've learned, you learn a lot. You learn.
Absolutely. So then ultimately Book of Mormon was the show that brought you back to Broadway after Grease. You joined, correct me if I'm wrong, you joined the company as a standby in 2012.
Technically, I joined as an understudy.
As an understudy? Okay.
As sort of a very superfluous understudy. But yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And then eventually ended up moving into a full-time Elder Cunningham position.
Right.
What are some of your biggest takeaways from your time with Book of Mormon? And what did it feel like to eventually move into that role full-time?
I loved that show. Both of my parents were ministers, you know, one Disciples of Christ and one Methodist, and I am a homosexual, and I had a sort of a falling out of my Christian faith in a certain sense in my younger days. And since then, I've been sort of trying to understand my spiritual life without the sort of form, if that makes sense.
Sure.
And so doing something like Book of Mormon that sort of pointed out the hypocrisy of every faith, but in the end was still pro-faith. I don't know, you know, if I'd gotten to do Torch Song, it would have been different. But because I didn't, I can still say that like telling the story of the Book of Mormon was the most gratifying experience on Broadway. You know, being able to be, you know, the underdog who becomes the hero in the end. You know, every time, you know, spoiler alert, but every time I turned around the book at the end that said the Book of Arnold, I would just burst into tears. You know what I mean? The fact that this guy wins, it was so... And this really started, I guess, in this place as well. Like, I'm cast because of my heart. I can open my heart and just let it fly. And this was a character who didn't know that that was a bad thing. He didn't understand that he shouldn't be this excited to be in Africa. You know what I mean? It was so beautiful to play somebody who does not see negative obstacles. You know, I'm always cast as a clown, but there's always these moments where I get to show that real heart and to show that, you know, so having those moments like that, and in the end, fucking up so bad, fucking, you know, and just really going from that complete destruction to becoming the savior, to the hero, you know, it's a cathartic experience every time. And sort of like Grease, the backstage life of that show, I don't think I feel bad about saying this now, was an absolute nightmare. It was it was when they were sort of turning into a machine, and a lot of people, like, I didn't get fired, but a lot of people got fired around me. They made like really weird choices and then had to correct them and do all this stuff. And it was just, I left because I couldn't live under a bullseye anymore. Right. The comedy, I couldn't even control the comedy anymore because it had been so abused. I don't know how to say that. It was really, really, I think it's better now. You know, I think it was just a hard time. I don't, you know, I'm not saying, oh, it's terrible. It was just like, I knew that I couldn't handle it anymore. And I started auditioning and gotten a year's worth of work out of Harmony and the National Tour of Elf. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, okay, I, you know, it's not like I'm leaving. And with that, it was just like, I knew I had to have something, but for something that I loved so much, it was just too painful to try and navigate all of my personal life throughout it.
You've done a variety of swing, understudy, standby contracts over the years, from Book of Mormon to School of Rock to Torch Song, and then again in Beetlejuice. What are some of the most difficult aspects of being a standby that people don't realize? And what are some of the most rewarding?
I think what's really difficult is that you really have to make sure that you're ready to go on. I know that sounds pretty simple, like, oh, you got to be, but it's like, that takes a lot. And it also creates a lot of disappointment if you don't. It's this weird balance of, you know, and it's the same thing where for auditions, where like, if you don't go at 100, if you don't give an opening night performance, you're not going to get it. But when you put all of that work and trust and love into something like that, when you don't get it, there's a fall. There's a, you know, it hurts. So I sort of got over the hurt of it, but it still is this thing that happens to your body. You know what I mean? Where it's just like, you're getting yourself ready. You have to make sure. And especially with something like School of Rock, that required a lot to make sure that I was ready to go on at any moment. So that's the worst part of it. You know, and Alex didn't call out for 200 performances when we first opened.
School of Rock?
Beetlejuice. Sorry. Okay. And I could not relax. No matter how well I learned the part, because I hadn't gone on, there was no way my body could just be like, okay, you got this.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't. I just couldn't do it. So I was just sort of on it. And the same thing happened at Book of Mormon. I didn't go on for 6 months when I first started there, which I thought would be the longest. And then Alex topped it with 9.
Wow. But, that's crazy.
But those times are also like the longest I've gone in my career without performing. It's like while being employed. So it's this terrible sort of dichotomy and this sort of feeling like I'm in the show, but I'm not in the show. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And there'll even be things of just like, the other difficult part about that is that like, you know, I've even had sort of like friends or peripheral friends who come to see the show and just don't even tell me that they're here because I'm not on. You know what I mean? Things like that, where it's just like, I don't feel like I'm really a part of the show until I'm in it. Okay. So then going into that, that's obviously the best part of it. You know, and what I know that part of my shtick, I learned in Greece that part of what I give to an audience is surprise. When I started singing Mooning, you know, you could hear a gasp from the audience because they didn't expect this like crude clown character to just sing all of a sudden, you know? And so that's why I think producers love me as an understudy, because I am giving an amazing performance and the audience gets to feel like they're seeing a star being born, if that makes sense. Totally. Because they don't expect it. They don't expect the understudy to be funny or to be a great singer, to do these things. So the fun part is the win. Not so much Beetlejuice. Beetlejuice fans were just like so there for everything happened.
Yeah.
But like especially School of Rock or Book of Mormon or all the, you know, these things where it has a crossed-armed, like prove it quality at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And Book of Mormon was the worst because they paid hundreds of dollars. You know what I mean? It was the Hamilton
at that time.
And they were pissed. They were pissed that they weren't seeing the real guy, you know? So it would take them, you know, sometimes I would just
win him over,
but I'd always win. I've never lost an audience, if that makes sense. You know, it's, you know, and I love hearing from people of just like, they shouldn't say it, but they're like, I was so disappointed when I saw the slip in the playbill, but I couldn't, you know, and now they're waiting at the stage door.
And now they're waiting to meet you after,
And that's what's kind of, you know, it is kind of this wonderful thing. You know, I mean, on one hand, I hate being underestimated, but on the other hand, it's really fun to just be like, yeah.
Give me the challenge. Yeah, it's almost like more rewarding in a sense, I guess.
Yeah.
Right? Beetlejuice had a bit of a slow start in the beginning, but then the show gained this enormous social media following thanks to TikTok and Instagram and just became a mega hit. So what did it feel like to be on the inside of that unique modern day, if you will, experience of a social media blow up?
You know, I talk about underestimation. I've never seen the theater community underestimate such a good piece of theater. I remember, you know, because even when I joined, I watched the movie and I was like, what the fuck is this? Like, it would, you know, and then I read the script and the script made sense of the movie. But it wasn't until I was in the first day, like one of the first days of rehearsal, they brought me in before any of the other swings because they were like, you have to learn a lot. And I did.
Yeah.
But they were doing Invisible. They were doing the opening number. And Sophia said the lyrics like, you're invisible when you're sad in this completely disassociated way. And I was like, I literally started crying and I was like, is this Beetlejuice? You know what I mean? I couldn't believe how touching it was. And in the same way, they added that scene in the middle of home, like in the middle of rehearsals for New York. And like, that was another moment where I was just like, is this Beetlejuice? Is this, you know what I mean? Like, this is too rich. This is too good for something you know, sort of surface level.
Yeah.
And that's what was brilliant about it to me was just that it went, as soon as you gave it the story of this girl losing her mother, it just opened up the show for me and made it like, this is why it sings in a way for me. Yeah. And so even when like reviews came out, I was genuinely shocked because I have a pretty good sense of taste, I think. Like, and I see a lot of theater, and especially with this, like I had no stake in Beetlejuice. I could easily say like, well, I don't like the show, but I got a job. You know what I mean? It was, right. I had not given anything to it. It was not emotional to me in that way.
Right.
And I was shocked that Ben Brantley was reviewing it as if it was trying to be the band's visit. That's what I couldn't understand, was just like, you know, I even noticed even just in the age demographic of reviewers that anyone over 50 was like, what is this? And anyone under 50 was like, this is fun. You know, so I was like,
yeah,
okay, and that maybe that's it. Maybe it is a generational thing. There is so much stimuli going on, but we have a lot of stimuli thrown at us these days. Like kids can handle
exactly
a beautiful set that pops out and has projection, you know, and all these things. So
absolutely,
I knew from the beginning that it was just completely misunderstood, completely underestimated. And I was at the Tony Awards. I was actually sitting with my Torch Song family while the Beetlejuice cast performed, which was a great moment. You know, I mean, like that Tony Awards, I was like, I'm here representing two shows that
two
are
shows.
Like, I love my life. Nobody knows I'm in either of
these
shows.
It's a good
shows,
year.
It's cool.
Yeah.
And I heard the reaction from the audience beforehand when Beetlejuice was mentioned for like a nomination.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, oh. And then when Beetlejuice performed, I heard all of them lose their minds. And I was like, none of you saw this. None of you came to see this. It was this thing where I realized you all heard it was bad, or you read the, you know what I mean? And none of you saw this. And people say it was TikTok and all these things. I think it was the performances that they did on the Tonys and that they did on The View and all these things. And the Thanksgiving Day Parade that pushed it into the world because people were like, oh, I see what this is. There was finally a representation of what this musical was and how funny it really was. So it was like this amazing moment at the Tonys, but I was also like very angry because I was just like, this is my community and you guys are voting on this. You have to see the shows. You have to see that, because I knew that if the Tony voters had seen the show, we would have won at least set. That is one of the most incredible sets that has ever been created for Broadway. So the fact that we didn't get that, and this might sound whatever, but it's like, I knew that the Tony voters didn't even come to see
this. Didn't
show.
Go.
No. And I still think that it should be a requirement, or that they're not allowed to vote on the category if they have not seen every nominated.
Yeah.
But the world caught up. That was the other, you know, I mean, the world caught up to it. And really, you know, the reviews in the end did not matter, you know,
other than
the fact that it created the one week that the Schuberts were able to zoom in on to say, you're not giving us what we wanted that one week in May, you know, or whatever. So that's the only tragedy of it, really.
It was just crazy because I saw it very early on and like, you know, the house was pretty full. The audience was engaged in the show and definitely more and more as the show went on. But I saw it February of this year, maybe. Mm. And it was like I was at a freaking rock concert. I mean,
absolutely.
The second the downbeat started, the audience was just screaming and the energy did not falter throughout the entire performance. So
no, I've never honestly, you know, and I've never experienced anything like that. You know, especially once it was like the preview audience was like all the crazy like Beetlejuice movie fan.
Yeah.
And that was nuts. We knew that would be nuts. But then like 2 months later, that was all the time. And it was now Beetlejuice musical fans. When you heard that scream as soon as the downbeat started backstage, like you were just like, okay. They're, you know, and especially as a understudy, even when I'd lower the paper, you know, they'd applaud for me because they knew who I was. Where I was just like, this is crazy. I've never, and that to me, I think is the power of social media in general now when it comes to Broadway things, is there is this sense of, you know, when I was a kid, I had to find the playbills to look up who these people were, you know what I mean? Do all these things and go to the stage door. That was my Instagram page where I could, you know, finally see these people. So it's a very different world now. People feel much more personally connected to the shows and the performers themselves.
To go more in that route, social media obviously has been helpful in the Beetlejuice case to, you know, help it grow, but it also comes with its pros and cons. Did you encounter any negative social media experiences with fans of the show at all over time? Was there any, you know, internet trolls, any people who were upset if an understudy was on at that show? And what was that like, if at all?
No, I mean, I think there's a general, you know, as an understudy, you're always going to be compared to the person that you're covering. But luckily with Alex, too, I'm just so different. Like, while we might play brothers in something, we are very, very different people, very different performers. And so it was, you know, there were certain things of just like, well, I like Alex's version better. It's like, okay, you know, that doesn't hurt me. You know, there's plenty of other people being like, you're my favorite Beetlejuice. And I'm like, shh, you know, it's like this weird, you know, even just saying like preference in that sense, it's like controversial, I suppose, but it just doesn't bother me in any way. I guess too, this is, and it started sort of with Torch Song, but I've never been more myself on stage. I think it was like the mask of Beetlejuice was really helpful. Like, it's, you know, watching myself sort of get into another person's skin. It started with Moises Kaufman in Torch Song saying like, release the mask, don't take the mask. And I was like, I need the mask. Like, please, I need it. This material's too hard to take inward. You know what I mean? But Beetlejuice was just so silly, you know, as a singer, it's just like, okay, I got this, you know, I have the mask. I don't need to put on a mask. And so I was just myself, you know. Friends loved seeing it because they were just like, you were just you up there.
Just,
you know,
having a good old time up there.
Exactly. It's just like me just having the most fun that I can have. Even if somebody was like, oh, I don't like it, there were like 1,000 other people who were screaming for it. I try not to let those things... Yeah, but I have to say, like, not to be like, nobody says anything bad about me, I can watch them come. But you know, I look sometimes, I'm just like, is somebody talking shit? And it's just like, no, you know, I don't know if I'm even controversial enough to even talk shit about, you know, if that makes sense. But I'm honestly always overwhelmed by the amount of kindness and love that people do throughout me. And it's so much that I realize I don't know how to accept love outside of a stage. And so social media creates this barrier for me in a way where I actually don't know how to respond without writing everyone like a gigantic love note of just like, yeah, you know. So it's sort of, you know, strange in that way for me. I much prefer a stage door interaction, you know, to the social media world still.
Beetlejuice, and also in School of Rock, you've done some crazy physically demanding roles. How do you find that stamina when you're not on every single night? How do you keep it up? And what are some of the most challenging moments in Beetlejuice that you have found for yourself?
Well, School of Rock, I convinced them to get me a personal trainer, especially because I wasn't on all the time, because there's no way that I was going to push myself in a workout in the same way that just the first 10 minutes of that show did. That show is actually like mean, I would say, physically and especially vocally. I guess I maybe shouldn't call out everybody, but like there were a lot of vocal hemorrhages from Dewey's. You know what I mean? Like including myself, including Alex. I think, you know, he's talked about it publicly, you know, and I won't say all the others, but it just like, it was mean. And I was sort of kind of in the same way with Book of Mormon. I was kind of like the guinea pig of just like, well, Will can do it. And so it wasn't until I hemorrhaged that they started changing the music. They sort of blamed the first guy for it and then blamed Alex for it. And then when I did it, they were like, okay, maybe. You know, I was like, well, yeah!
Now we can change it.
So that was another reason. That was actually a huge reason why I left that show as well, because it was unlike Book of Mormon, where like the story I was telling was so incredible. You know, I mean, it meant so much to me. Like in School of Rock, it wasn't, you know, you walked away from that show being like, those kids were amazing. Not that guy sang great. You know what I mean? And so I was like, this isn't worth it to me to sort of, you know, and even my ENT said, you either need to have surgery or you need to not sing for a year. And I was like,
oh God.
Bye.
Bye.
You know, and I wanted to start my directing career anyway. So I went to London and I was Lonnie Price's assistant, did some directing over there until I needed to come make money here again. but that was it. It was just that it was an easier decision because it was just like, well, I don't love telling this story. I don't need to tell this story in the same way that I did with like something like Book of Mormon or even Harmony or something that or like it just feels like it would be worth it to destroy myself for this, you know. But it was like, I compared doing a performance of School of Rock to the machine in Princess Bride that takes a year off of your life. I'm not even kidding. Like it was, and the worst part about it too is I did all the matinees and then I had to be in the ensemble in the evening shows. And it was awful. I mean, like I was dead. Like I'd used up all of my adrenaline. Like I called it like adrenaline fatigue because I was just dead. I was just like remarkably dead. And it would have been something if I had like actually had a role, but it was literally like the cut track in the show. You know what I mean? I was replaced by a Louis Vuitton purse. I'm not even kidding. Like, when they had to cut the track. So I was just like,
oh my God.
All around, it was just like a big old mess. But I've never had to be in such good shape with that. Like the personal trainer, you know what I mean? Like that was the time when I was just like, okay. But it was also the same thing with Book of Mormon is like, the more prepared you make yourself to do this part, the less you look like the part that they want you to be. You know what I mean? It's crazy that I've sort of played all these sort of like big guys who run around the stage for 2.5 hours. And then they're like, why are you losing weight?
Because I'm sweating out everything.
Nicola, let me show you your choreography. And the Beetlejuice was sort of no different, except it was a little easier. I will say there was one time when Alex called out maybe like 20 minutes into the show. He was like, I'm so sorry. And I'm like, this is great. You know what I mean? Like the first 20 minutes are terrible. Like, it's just like, don't leave the stage. You're running. You're putting on 3D glasses and doing, you know, all this shit. So he was like, I'm so sorry. I was like, this is my ideal show. Starting from the scene where I just get to slaughter the audience with humor. It was really for that show just being prepared for the first 20 minutes, because even I had to learn how to do the monologue at the beginning after a whole being dead thing, just completely out of breath, just like, oh, you know, like knowing where my voice would sit when I can't breathe. Yes, I'm always playing these kind of characters, and it always depends on me doing some kind of outside physical endurance training. No matter what I do in the gym, nothing compares to the adrenaline that's being pumped in singing. You know, I'm not going to start belting at Equinox. Like, I'm just not going to do it. I'm not that guy. So,
I'm sure there are some.
Yeah, I'm sure. Man, that's not me. You meant like the whole being dead thing, just like on the elliptical. Not it. Although I really wanted to do it with School of Rock. Like, I needed to do that for like, there's only so much you can really prepare until it's time.
Until you're forced into it. In Beetlejuice, did you put on that voice that Alex was doing, or was that a case by case?
I did not. I can't do it. He literally, you know, even his ENT, you know, released the footage of his vocal cords showing how he's doing it safely. It's not even his vocal cords. It's what's called false folds, which are above your vocal cords that some people just have control of. And like, for instance, like Harvey Fierstein's vocal cords are damaged. So he's been forced to use his false folds to speak. And that's why he sounds the way he does. Kind of like Beetlejuice voice. I do not have muscular control over those folds. And even at one point he was like, oh, I can get you in with my teacher. And I was like, I'm not even close to it. Let's not try. And it was a good challenge for me to just say, like, in my callbacks, like that's what they told me. They were like, we needed to know that this part could be done without the voice. But that was it. That, you know, I proved to them that, yeah, the voice doesn't really matter. And I would throw in, you know, like, the best I have is vocal damage by just like flinging my, you know, like, hey, hi, you know, like, and it's not good. I just do it. I would do it sort of at like my first line, I'd be like, holy crap. You know, I'd do a little bit of grind just to let them hear it. The audience will be like, oh, I know it's Beetlejuice. And then I'd phase it out. For me, you know, it was Timbers or Brightman said something along the lines of like, the character's like a broken record, you know, and that he just keeps skipping from all these different things, you know, and I was like, I'll just do characters. I'll just, you know, I mean, like, you'll forget that I'm not doing the Beetlejuice voice because I'll be the cowboy or I'll be the gay therapist or I'll do, you know, I mean, I'll just keep on jumping in and out of these things so that you don't even notice that I'm not doing the Beetlejuice voice.
Okay.
It was another challenge from the beginning to say, okay, I can't do this. What can I do? I did the national tour of Hair and I replaced Josh Lehman, who, in my opinion, is the funniest person on the entire planet. Just as a you know, I mean, he'll just like, he's like Beetlejuice.
So quick.
He's like switch characters in person. And so when I was replacing him, I was like, that was my first sense of just like, okay, I'm not as funny as this guy. I can't be him. So what do I do? And then luckily, you know, I mean, I got another dose of that like a couple months later by covering Josh Gad and looking at Josh Gad and be like, I cannot do that. Following Josh, following both Joshes, I started coming up with my own formula, looking at the script fresh and just saying, okay, who is this character? What do I do? What do I do? And so that again happened with School of Rock with Alex and looking at him being like, okay, I can't do that, you know, especially because I always say steal the gold and fill in the rest. It's not like I like looked at Josh Gad's phone and I was like, no. And I was like, I can do that. I can do that, but yeah. I can't do that. So what do I do here? And Alex has been an amazing, you know, challenge in that sense to say like, okay, we are so similar. People are going to expect certain things. What can I do? What can I twist? What can I do? And what can I take from him that actually works for me? But especially with Alex, there's certain, he has such sort of a laissez-faire quality to him, you know, a very dead, he can do deadpan in a certain way that where if I do deadpan, I look lazy. It looks like I'm tired. Like my face is so expressive and all these things where it just looks like I'm not trying. And so I had to learn that. I had to learn it, which unfortunately at times means that I have to give a lot more energy in a certain sense.
Sure.
So the Beetlejuice voice was like the epitome of that. It's like looking at Josh Lane and being like, I can't do that. What? You know? And so luckily, I also had come up with my character for Beetlejuice before I had seen Alex do it. I had done, you know, it was just in callbacks. Like, I hadn't seen him do any of it yet. So I was like, hold on to this. Hold on to, you know, like, don't stray out to sea into something that's not you, you know. But at the same time, Alex is brilliant and would do all these choices, like, even in tech, just, like, fooling around. But, like, in the middle of... you know, like when he's about to be summoned at the dinner party, he like did a pocket, you know, compact thing, you know, and like put it down. And he did it once and never did it again. And I stole it. I was like, well, that's mine forever now. That's like, that's the beauty of being an understudy as well. You can see what works, even if maybe the actor doesn't know if it works, you know, in that moment, like no way of knowing, but I'm in the audience and I say, I know what moving your arm this way does, you know, I know. So I was really sort of, especially after not going on for 9 months, really carefully craft every single moment. And 50% of it was stolen bits, stolen one-time bits from Alex Brightman, because he just has them to spare. That was, you know, he's that kind of mind where I'm much more calculated and type A. Like, I'll give the room for the comedy to live, but I like to know, I like to know the shell of it. Whereas, you know, basic Brightman has no problem saying there is no shell, go fuck yourself. You know, like, which I admire, you know, I mean, is following him, he's turned me into a much more liberal actor, I would say. Almost like, I am much more, I can think on my feet easier. I can do, you know, things that are outside of what I would consider safe, you know?
Okay.
He's just so bold. He is just so, so nonchalantly bold. You know, he doesn't think anything. But to me, I'm just like, oh, you're a bold man. And he's like,
well. Who cares?
So it's been a wonderful, it's been a wonderful thing for my performing career, even just having to sort of follow him, for sure.
I think right now in this time of, you know, the Broadway shutdown and an uncertainty of a sense in our industry's future, a lot of artists are questioning their future in the business. Was there a time in your career that you have thought about leaving or quitting, and what made you stick it out, if so?
Yes. Specifically because I maybe never leave the business altogether. I don't know what I do. I think, and I have, no matter how frustrated I might get at certain parts of our establishment or whatever, that I still think that the art form is good and important. And I have no other place in the world than in it. So I did leave performing after School of Rock because it was, I guess I don't feel bad saying, like, it was traumatic. It was completely, for not only just like vocally and physically, but once again, the backstage life was pretty wretched. And in a lot of senses, I sort of act on good faith with a lot of people, especially being an understudy and saying, okay, I'm willing to sort of take this under literal position, but you have to be good to me. You know what I mean? You have to respect me and you have to value my talent and value my time. And especially after acting sort of as guinea pig in Book of Mormon and especially in School of Rock. And in both cases, my hard work and blatant achievement were rewarded with keeping me as a standby. In both cases, they knew how valuable I was in that position. And even though I had done everything to prove that I deserved to be leading a company, even if it's not the Broadway company, you know, they did not act on that good faith in the way that they really should have. And it really broke. That's the nicest way I can talk about it.
Of course.
But it really, both of those experiences broke me in a very real way. And especially School of Rock, because the vocal damage was on top of that.
Yeah.
And so I did not sing for a year, and mainly because it was traumatic. I didn't enjoy it. And I still, if I have to sing above an A, I literally have the feelings of the beginning of a panic attack.
And I
don't feel bad about saying, because I know other people, yeah. especially even who girls who've played Elphaba understand yeah. this girl, you know, or people who've been fired from shows understand this aspect of like, well, I don't want to be near you. That sense of like, yeah. you're my greatest love, but you hurt me. And so I knew that I wanted to switch into directing anyways. I'd met Lonnie Price and he was like, you're a director. And I was like, I know. And so it was to me, having that way out, I was like, okay, let's go. And I even left the Broadway community because I was like, okay, maybe London will be nicer. Yeah. You know, or maybe London will want to do the kind of theater that I want to do. And the problem is that business is the business everywhere, and people are going to see you how they want to see you, and kindness and wanting to be giving. And I'm too giving. Like, I would do it all for free. Like, I just love theater. I want, as long as I have a place to sleep and food to eat, I would do it for free. And so that gets taken advantage of really yeah. easy by people. And they say, okay, well, then you're an understudy. And I take it because I'm glad to be doing theater.
Yeah.
But now I can firmly say that I'll just never be an understudy again, because nobody's really... Beetlejuice was wonderful and they treated me like a king. But I've proven over and over again that I... am not an understudy, and the only thing keeping me in that position is me saying yes, I'll do it. So I can firmly say that, like, no, I'm not an understudy anymore. I loved it, you know. I mean, I definitely am forever grateful for all of the remarkable roles that I've gotten to play, which I may not have been able to play otherwise if I hadn't said yes to being understudy. So the things that they've taught me are invaluable, but it's time to move on. But that's the close, you know. That's the closest I've felt in a lot of ways to leaving altogether was after. Mm-hmm. After.
I've been asking all of my guests how they're finding moments of positivity and hope in this difficult year. I imagine that one of your answers would be your recent staging of Floyd Collins in your apartment with cardboard boxes galore. I watched it. It was absolutely brilliant and brought me so much joy. For those listeners who may have not seen it, can you explain what you did, what you created, and what inspired you to do so?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is the thing I'm like surprisingly like most proud of in my career now. I'd been doing a lot of like silly sort of like, you know, music videos sort of things with using the acapella app. And I don't know how it happened. I guess I just started singing this portion of the show, like almost right as quarantine started. And obviously there was like this sort of connection between a man who is isolated in a cave and me who is isolated in my apartment. Not to say I'm like trapped and gonna die, but that same sense of just sort of being disconnected from people and not knowing when you're gonna get out. I had done the show in college, and I always said, like, well, I peaked in college because I played Floyd Collins. And I was like, I know I'll never play this part again, because who's going to believe that I can like fit through a hole in a cave? You know what I mean? I was the one who sort of put myself in that box that Broadway taught me. I, you know, immediately when I went from playing Floyd Collins in college to Horton the Elephant, I went from playing like these amazing, you know, Jamie in Last 5 Years, this guy was cast right. for my voice in school, to playing, you know, Horton and Roger and Elder Cunningham and all these yeah. things. So I knew how the world wanted to see me. And then I think a part of it was knowing that like producers weren't going to call this year. And to just say, okay, you're your own producer, stack your season, what do you want to do? And I got in touch with my friend Andy Einhorn, who's an amazing music director, and the music for Floyd Collins is so challenging, I knew I needed somebody sort of remarkable. And he said yes. You know, I just said I want to do something theatrical. I didn't know what I wanted to do with it yet. He said yes, and that was a great sort of kickoff to just be like, okay, this is really happening. I've got fucking Andy Einhorn, you know, helping
yeah.
me. Now this is... this can be good. And I came up with a lot of ideas of how I wanted to do it. And I, you know, a lot of ideas. And then finally sort of started trailing back and told him, you know, I was like, maybe I'll just get like a nice microphone and like do it. And he was like, well, the only reason I wanted to do this with you is because you wanted to do something theatrical. So what do you want to? And I was like, okay. Oh. And I think I had the idea sort of in the back of my mind the whole time, but knew that it was crazy. Knew that building a cave out of cardboard in my apartment would be insane. And and it was. But when, you know, I said to myself, what's the most theatrical thing I can do? You know, and I thought of that and I was just like, oh no. This is it. This is it. This is
it's gotta happen.
And so I started building. And I came up, well, I did like a dry run and just sort of figured out how long I needed to make it, or, you know, basically how much of the apartment I could even fill up with it in order to sustain like 6 minutes of crawling right. and singing. And so I did that and I started building and it all came together. You know, I mean, wow. there's a million metaphors built into it. But the experiment really was, can I make this theater? I'm going to do this on film, but I want people to say, this is theater. And to me, that was the point of the cardboard, of being able to see the cardboard, is knowing that I'm in a cardboard fort in my apartment, but by minute seven, minute eight, you're probably giving into it. You're probably gonna sort of, you know, you're gonna see that I'm yodeling into a piece of paper with a hole in it, but it's gonna be magical. And that was sort of insisting on these theatrical elements when for film, we are so accustomed to being actualized. Like I did not paint it. It does not look like a cave, you know, in that sense.
Right.
It ended up being, I sort of realized my feelings behind it were, it's a show very much about death and about, you know, a torturous, torturous death. And this portion that I was focusing on was the only part of the show that had nothing to do with death. And I realized, you know, and it was the death of Breonna Taylor was the impetus behind my Heart and Music video. I needed to sing. I needed to spread love. You know, it's like I wanted to like throw joy at people because I was suffering and it was the only way that I could sort of help it. And Floyd Collins was sort of the epitome of that, where it's just like all of these deaths had piled up, whether it was George Floyd or Breonna Taylor, and then all of the COVID deaths.
Mm-hmm.
And on a personal level, I was dealing with my not being able to see my father, who has early onset Alzheimer's. And that for me, this huge connection of all of that to say, you know, let's not think about the tragedy that ends these people's lives. You know, like the reason Floyd Collins is known for his death, for his terrible death. George Floyd is known for his terrible death. You know, and the same thing with Breonna Taylor. And in terms of Alzheimer's, that's how people are, you know, it's like people, that's how people are. And part of me wanted to say, let's focus on the most glorious moments of these people's lives to say, okay, yes, death is coming, but right now, there's glory, there's love, there's joy. And that's what I wanted to give. I wanted to give it to my father and I wanted to give it to the world. I just wanted to give a moment and a reminder that even in something that is made up of tragedy, that we should think about, that we should remember the glory that this person achieved in their life, you know?
Thank you for sharing that about your father and his early onset Alzheimer's. My grandmother has had dementia for the past 10 years, and it's really, you know, difficult to watch someone you love go through that and feel some sort of loss, even though they're right in front of you. When was the last time your father saw you on stage, and how has this whole experience impacted your artistry or your relationship with art?
He got to see Beetlejuice, I think in February, maybe, which was really amazing. You know, my dad, you know, if I'm funny at all, you know, it's because of my dad. Like, I think I maybe have like a tenth of the humor that he has. And, you know, we're pretty far in. We're like, he's like in stage five, you know, but.
Okay.
And so I didn't know what, you know, what he would think of the show or if he, you know, whatever. And there were a couple times when I just heard him laugh all on his own. You know, it's something that, in a way, was a reflection of him. You know what I mean? It was like these little things that, you know, I didn't think about it in that way until I heard it. And I was like, oh my God, he recognized, he hears it. He knows what I'm doing. He's laughing, you know, and that means the world, you know, and the same thing with when I got to show, you know, both of my parents, the Floyd Collins video, you know, that just means everything, you know, to try and, I think in a way, with everything that we do, we try to honor our parents. We try to show them that they did a good job. You know, I think no matter what kind of relationship you even have, whether it's a good or bad relationship, I think there's part of everyone that longs to make their parents proud, make them
absolutely,
and even to see themselves reflected, you know, in a hopefully a good way.
Yeah.
I think in general, it's changed my life more than it's changed my art, but I think that's part and parcel, where I don't take a lot of things for granted that I would. It's made me more compassionate with everyone, because until recently, until I sort of spoke about it, nobody knew, you know, for the past 5 years that this is something that I've been dealing with. Right. And it has affected every part of my life emotionally, you know, especially, you know, on stage sometimes, it, you know, especially for something like Torch Song, you know, that was, it was a very different experience having sort of such a terribly rich, tragic emotional life.
Yeah.
Really sort of adds a certain spice to everything these days. But it's, it more than anything, it just made me grow up. It's made me understand really what it is to, you know, theater is my love language. It's my emotional life. I normally, you know, and I noticed even when I was doing the documentary about making Floyd Collins, that when I was talking about my dad, I wasn't crying, but I'd talk about Floyd and I would cry.
Mm.
And it was, you know, I realized the mask that I give, you know, and or the way that I use analogies and things like that, that that's my emotional life. And so I can't tell you, it's, I mean, it maybe sounds weird or whatever, but after doing Floyd Collins and especially after doing the documentary, which sort of turned into, I didn't intend to, you know, to sort of make it be about complete, you know, my father completely. But that's where it went. It was sort of a Franklin Shepard Inc. interview that went into this like terrible sadness, but I didn't want to push it away. I didn't, you know, that there's just one line in Floyd Collins when he says, no telling what's on these walls, layering on slow, like a stone history book, you know, and in that sense of being able to create a metaphor about Alzheimer's of saying, yes, there once was a river flowing through here, but even though it's dry, it's on the walls, it's here, it's all been imprinted. The history is there if you're willing to look close enough. I can't tell you how much more at peace I am about it, because it is one of those diseases where, you know, I've said the terrible things like, I wish it were just cancer, or I wish it had been anything that would have taken him without taking his mind first. Right. And there's terrible despair in that, and a complete loss of, I mean, when I look closely at how somebody who spent their life fighting for social and racial and economic justice is rewarded with something so brutal. You know, I don't know if everything happens for a reason, but let me try and make sense of this. Let me make something out of it. I had to not ever make anything out of his Alzheimer's, but to make something out of my sadness, to make something out of my despair, to make it mean something. And so hopefully that somebody can listen to me or watch me and feel less alone, you know what I mean, in it or something like that. Like that to me is the only thing that's made me sort of feel connected to the divine in all of it, you know, is just to say, if I use this pain for something, or if I can turn it into something beautiful, then maybe there's a God. You know, that sounds so extreme, but it's really, and so being able to make this, not only do something, you know, I said to myself, like, I am Floyd Collins. I don't care if you think I'm too fat or too whatever, or, you know, or too gay or too any of these things, be this part. I am this, and to sort of reclaim this and to sort of use this pain and this isolation and to do all of that. I've never been more proud of anything. And honestly, I can really, not that I'm like, if I die tomorrow, but I'm like, thank God I made this, because I can, I do hope that this is how people will remember me. And I love that in a certain sense, the people who I've been trying to get their attention for years now know me as the Floyd Collins guy. What? You know, like, that's, I would have never
went viral.
I mean, but that's, and especially to it. I mean, I loved Beetlejuice and I love the fandom that came with it, but nothing makes me happier knowing that like Ted Chapin knows me as the Floyd Collins guy, you know what I mean? And that Adam Gettle wrote me, you know what I mean? All these people, you know, just like are interested in me now, you know, and all these, it's knowing that it came from me is really touching, is really like, I've never felt like I've put myself on screen so honestly in every aspect, even just the cave, even the black tape of the cave,
right?
It's just so me. And so I thought, you know, like the Floyd Collins fans would like it. I was like, this is so niche, this is so whatever. And so seeing the response from it and knowing that I've turned like Beetlejuice fans into
Floyd, you know, Collins fans.
And you know, and a friend of mine was saying like their brother who's a dentist, you know, texted them saying like, this is how I dream. And I'm like, he's
oh my God.
He's like watching Floyd Collins. You know, it's just like,
wow.
Nothing is cooler to me than bringing sort of what I consider maybe unaccessible or so complex music that it's unaccessible, you know, inaccessible, and to bring it to a new audience. That's the best for me. That, I mean, because I love theater more than I love anything else. So the fact that I can spread that, it's best.
And it was like theater in its like most simple form, where we all, most of us all start with it, you know, just cardboard boxes and it, not all glitz and glamour, but just really about the art and the story that you're telling, which I think was so relatable to so many people.
And that's my bag with that, especially with directing. I'm very interested in what I call homemade magic, that sense of seeing the strange, you know, sort of our town, Angels in America rules. Yeah. You know what I mean? Where it's like, we don't have a set unless we need one. We do not have props unless we need it. And then when we do have something magical, you see the strings. You see, you know what you're looking at, you know, but you believe in it. That's what's beautiful to me. And that's what's theater to me is you know, and I always say, you know, the best way to describe it to me is like when there's a ghost, we do ghosts on stage better than we do in any movie could be. Because when somebody is live, standing next to somebody and does not see that person walking by them, magic. In a movie, that's nothing. In a movie, that's not, you know what I mean? But on stage, that absence of sight of that person and being thinking, I'm the only one who can see this person. Beautiful, beautiful.
Yeah. And how the audience can give into that so quickly, how we're so capable of.
Because it feels like a secret for us, you know?
Right, right. Yeah. The shutdown, you know, we keep talking about this, but there's just one more topic I want to briefly talk about. The shutdown has obviously been devastating to the livelihoods of so many people in our community, but it has also given us this moment to take a step back and reflect on the need for some desperate change, some desperate systematic change and racial equity in this business. What changes do you hope to see when theater returns?
I think that's great. I started doing like a podcast about this actually. I bet before I started getting before FlickCons happened, and then I got really wrapped up in that. But I think we need to talk about it. I think we need to keep on talking about it. You know, my podcast was called Stupid But Trying, because that's how I feel. It's just sort of like, I think we all need to acknowledge that we're at least ignorant or stupid when it comes to certain things. You know what I mean? And especially because the whole podcast stemmed out of my friend Gilbert in Beetlejuice saying the phrase, I'm just a black body telling a white story on stage. And I was like, oh my God, explain, talk to me, tell me. And so that's what I think we need people more curious about our black brothers and sisters experience and BIPOC people in general, but I specifically with, you know, everybody saying pick a path. I want to see more black performers, black artists, but especially behind the table. I'm really interested in it, I think because I know how hard it is to achieve anything on the other side of the table. And the reason that I came back from London was because I ran out of money. I couldn't work for free for another year. And that's what working behind the table requires.
Yeah.
It requires years and years and years of working for either nothing or you know, or for a very small amount, not a livable amount. So that's what I'm interested in. I think we need to create a bridge, because that's what I feel like. It's the jobs behind the table really have nothing to do, well, not to say nothing to do with talent, but it's not the first component. It is if you are elite enough to work for free for years. Yeah. And so, yes, there will be talented people in that group, but we are not getting the most talented people we can, because we are not opening up that field to people who cannot afford.
Exactly.
To, you know, who do not have a trust fund, who do not, you know, so, you know, it's partly selfish in that way, because I'm just like, I would like a path to the other side of the table as well, because I just didn't come from, you know, I came from ministers, you know what I mean? Right. They weren't, you know, like raking in the dough. But I think it becomes an very, very, very exclusive, not only white club, but just wealthy, wealthy club.
Absolutely.
Which I don't think is terribly connected to the actual heartbeat of the nation. And I do believe that that's why Broadway is literally sort of behind the times. Yeah. Off-Broadway last year was one of the most exciting seasons of anything I've ever experienced. And it's just such a stark contrast to the type of work that Broadway thinks the nation wants. Mm-hmm. You know? And we learn very quickly if that's true or not. But, I mean, and I think it's pretty generally accepted, but you know, I think everybody's pretty disappointed in the Broadway League itself. And nobody loves the Tony Awards more than me. Mm-hmm. But what a really terrible decision to try and throw a party in the middle of a funeral, I think. Yep. I think that's it. You're not going to do anything to try to revitalize our business, do not throw a party because we're dead, because you've made us dead. So let's not. And also, there's not enough nominees. It's embarrassing. It's really added on to next year. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, that's what I mean. It doesn't make any sense to me.
I know that that's controversial to say, but I actually think it's on the verge of offensive. So I don't feel bad voicing it.
Yeah, I said something on my account and people attacked the hell out of me.
I know. I respect. I mean, I haven't known who you are for a long time. I've respected your willingness to sort of speak out about really, sort of important things. So thank you.
Let's end it on a positive note. One last question. What would you like to say to 13-year-old Will Blum, who dreamt of a career on Broadway?
Oh my God. I don't know. I still feel like him. We're surprisingly just not very different. I still don't understand being on the other side of the stage door. You know, I pulled Anika Larsson off of a bus, when the Rent tour came to Nashville, after she was female soloist, and I just had to tell her, I put my legs in between, my head between my legs when I met Victoria Clark after Lighting the Piazza, because I was like hyperventilating, and even most recently I asked for, Tracy Bennett's autograph after End of the Rainbow, as an adult, I'd been on Broadway, but I was like, I have to get her autograph. I couldn't help it. And especially after the Floyd Collins video, there's been certain people, who I've talked to where I'm like, I refuse to acknowledge that you are my peer. You are, my idol. It's very hard for me to, and I guess that's the best thing too, because I can't remember a show, even when I haven't been enjoying myself backstage, I can't remember doing a show where I was like, can't believe I have to do this. And I hate people who are like that, because I know I was the kid. I know the kid. I am the kid who knows how exciting it is to be on Broadway, or just to be on a stage, to make people laugh, to make people, clap. It is an incredible, incredible privilege. And I think if my 13-year-old self knew just what I've accomplished, like if I told him, I've done 5 Broadway shows and I'm 36. How old am I? I can't remember. Oh my God, quarantine. I think it's 36. Oh God, I don't know.
Okay, wow. I had the moment the other day. I didn't know how old I was.
Well, my 13-year-old self would be more concerned that I can't remember how old I am, I guess, probably than, probably be pretty stoked about, if I listed the people that I've got to talk to. So I would tell him to not change a thing. I think so much of it has always hinged on insisting that this is what I was going to do. I didn't have parents who sort of pushed me into it. Like they really were like, really? And stopped me from doing shows when I was little because they wanted me to focus on schoolwork. My mom rigged the tape measure to make me think I was too tall when Les Mis came through town to cast Gavroche, And I was like, they did they did not see it as a viable career. So I've had to prove not only to myself, but to them that, yes, this is what I'm going to do with my life. So I really wouldn't change a thing, because it's led me on such a perfect path where, I couldn't have learned the lessons that I wouldn't have believed myself trying to explain to my 13-year-old self that part of Broadway would be hard. I would have just completely dismissed it. And I see it. I see it in kids now. I'll try and coach or do talkbacks and they're like, that's not me. That's not going to happen to me. I'm like, oh, it's definitely going to happen to you because you say it won't now.
Now it's destined to happen.
So it's I'm very thankful for even the hard parts of my journey have been really informative.
Well, a big thank you to Will Blum for taking the time out of your day to chat with us. It was an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. This is wonderful.
Hey, Broadway Belters listeners. If you enjoyed this episode, you can help us out by subscribing and leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can also follow us on Instagram at BUA Belters Podcast. And if you're feeling extra supportive, go ahead and share today's episode with a friend. The Broadway Belters Podcast was produced today by me, Nick Ferreo. Thank you for listening.